You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I'm speaking with Shiza Shahed, the co-founder and co-CEO of the homeware company, Our Place. Since launching in 2019, Our Place has become a massive hit, and chances are you're already familiar with the brand's signature pan, the Always Pan. Deep enough to boil pasta, shallow enough to fry an egg, and equipped with features like an easy pour spout, removable steamer basket, and nesting spatula, the Always Pan seeks to be the only pan you need. Today, the company has expanded into a full homeware assortment, including traditionware collections, celebrating everything from Lunar New Year to chosen family brunch. At its core, Our Place is centered in bringing people together around a home-cooked meal. But before Shiza was creating genius products that would become everyone's favorite quarantine purchase, she had quite an impressive former career, one that started as a business analyst in Dubai, then as co-founder of the Malala Fund, and eventually she started Now Ventures to support other mission-driven startups. It is quite the admirable and wild ride, and she's here to tell us all about it. Now, on Second Life, it's Shiza Shahed. Okay, so on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning. So, what did you study in school? And more importantly, what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
So, I grew up in Pakistan, and I was there till I was 18. And I grew up in a loving but modest family. My mother had an arranged marriage to my father when she was 19 years old and never got to really pursue her career or education. She's great now. She runs an orphanage and is super fulfilled and living her best life. But when I was growing up, it was really important to my parents to give me every opportunity that they never had. So I was very fortunate, but I was also growing up in a country that was facing a very turbulent time. Pakistan's a beautiful country. It's a very diverse country, but it is a very poor country. And it's a country where women and girls are forced to deal with some unthinkable circumstances. It's a country that has the second highest number of children out of school in the entire world. It's ranked the second worst place to be born a woman. And when I was growing up, things were getting worse. There was rising instability in the region, and I was trying to make sense of the world around me. And so I actually spent most of my time getting my education not in school, but in the world, in the communities around me. I would leave school as soon as I could, take a couple of classes and bounce, and then go and volunteer. And really anywhere I could get my foot in the door, anywhere I could be useful, I would show up. I started out carrying medical supplies when I was 13 years old in a women's prison. From there, I started writing case studies about women who were starting their own businesses through microloans and microfinance. From there, I volunteered in an earthquake relief camp when my country was struck with a massive natural disaster. And I was always working with women and girls and really understanding what happens when you invest in women, which is you get an outsized return on your investment. In that for every dollar a woman earns, she invests 80 to 90% back into her family and community. It's typically 30 to 40% for men. So if there's a silver bullet in ending poverty, it's really economically empowering women. And all of that to say, I think I always knew that I would do something to support women.
So you ended up leaving for school eventually. How did that come about?
I was really lucky to get a full scholarship to come to the United States to go to school at Stanford University. And so that's how I moved to America at 18. It's the first time I was exposed to startups. And, you know, there's no word for entrepreneur in my native language, Urdu. The closest is probably, you know, businessman. I certainly haven't seen women entrepreneurs around me. And so it was really at Stanford that I first came to contemplate that I could maybe build my own mission-driven business one day.
So what did you do after you graduated? What was your first step?
When I graduated, I took my first job out of college at McKinsey. I moved out to Dubai to be closer to home and because I wanted to work in emerging markets. And like any good college graduate, I had my elaborate five-year plan. I thought I would do the McKinsey training program, which is typically 3 years. I would then get my business school tuition covered because McKinsey will pay for business school as long as you promise to come back. And so that was my plan, to really earn my pedigree, my stripes, and then maybe one day go out in the world and do my own thing. But of course, the universe had different plans.
The universe definitely had different plans, and we'll get into all of that. But first, I'm curious because we've had a few people on the podcast who have worked at McKinsey here in the States, but not internationally. So I'm curious about the types of projects you were working on, what types of companies you were working with, and what you liked about the job, and more importantly, what didn't feel like a perfect fit.
Oh my goodness, you're going to get me to violate my NDAs. No, I moved out to Dubai to be closer to home, but also because at the time, out of the Dubai office, McKinsey was doing a massive education reform project in Pakistan. It was one of their largest projects that really did come from a very good place in terms of driving impact. And so I was really hoping to work on that project, which didn't happen for me. But I got to work with a range of clients in Abu Dhabi, in Doha, in Dubai, in Egypt. And it was a really fun experience. I mean, I got to travel places that I probably wouldn't have. You know, it was in Cairo after the revolution and was able to stay there and build relationships and get to know people. And the office was so international, and you around the table, everybody came from a different place and was there to build something. And so all of that was really exciting, and it felt like, you know, I was a part of something. And for me, you know, as a Pakistani citizen at the time, you know, travel is hard, and you don't get visas to go to places, and, you know, just your passport itself presents a lot of obstacles. And so to be able to live and work and travel everywhere, it was really exciting, really, really smart people. But, you know, when you're working as a consultant, you are not part of the business, you're not part of building it. You advise on it, you share ideas, and then your project is done and you leave. And I think I've always liked to build and to be in that seat and to be fully bought in and to give it my all and to have to deal with the consequences of my decisions, the good and the bad. And so I think building is very different from consulting or advising, although both are really valuable.
That makes sense. I'm curious about what the dynamic with clients was like, because no shade to you or your skill set whatsoever, but you were so young. And I can't help but imagine, like, here is this young woman who's just graduated. You obviously have a breadth of life experience, but at the same time, that's not the same as, you know, lived experience in a certain field and your advising. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think as women, we're always too young until we're too old. And
Oh my gosh, I've never heard that exact phrase, and that is a fact.
And so, you know, I have had, and I still continue to have, you know, and not really at McKinsey, because McKinsey is set up where in every team you have associates and analysts, and then you have partners, and there's a role for everybody to sort of, you know, mitigate against any sense of, wait, is a 22-year-old the one coming up with these ideas? But, you know, really after McKinsey and the work that I've done since then, I've had multiple experiences where people have looked at my face in a meeting and asked me how old I am, sweetheart. And that's been a very, very common experience for me. And then one day you're too old. So
I can't tell you how frustrated I have been over the years when people looked at me and my fellow co-founder and just assumed because we were women in our mid-20s that we didn't know what we were talking about. It's so frustrating. But in the long run, I guess knowing what you can do and actually proving that ultimately is the last laugh. So I guess, guess I'm laughing. I guess. Okay, so as you mentioned, you didn't do the full 5-year plan that you had in your head. You left after 2 years. So can you tell me a little bit about how you came to that decision and what you decided to do next?
Yeah, I mean, I was about a year into my time at McKinsey when my dear friend Malala Yousafzai was shot for her courage, for her advocacy for girls' education. And I was devastated by what had happened, and I was with her and her family in their hospital the next couple of weeks. And thankfully, miraculously, she recovered and came back stronger and braver than ever. It's probably the greatest miracle I'll ever witness. And being there and going through that, I realized I couldn't go back to my spreadsheets or my 5-year plan, and I had to make something good come of this horrible thing that had happened. And Malala and her family asked me to stay with them and support them in sharing her story, in building an organization around girls' education as a cause. And, you know, I remember sitting at my desk at McKinsey trying to work on a model for something, and I kept switching tabs to this email I was writing to help share Malala's story, and I realized I had to leave. And so I ended up quitting my job at McKinsey, moving to New York with a suitcase and starting the Malala Fund with Malala and her father.
So what did that transition look like, and how did you set yourself up so that you felt comfortable making that leap? What were the early days like? I mean, that had to have been both exhilarating and also absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I like to try and look to the future with optimism and hope. And it was scary for sure. I had no savings. I was a year out of college. I have a Pakistani passport, which means, you know, getting a visa to live and work anywhere other than Pakistan is not easy. And I remember a conversation with a friend of mine at the time, and I was really struggling with this because, you know, I was a 22-year-old from Pakistan, Malala was a 15-year-old from Pakistan, and we didn't know that anybody would care beyond the breaking news cycle, let alone support and invest in our ideas. And I remember he looked at me and said, "Tell me what your worst case is." And I said, "Well, you know, I could fail and not have a job and have no way to support myself." And he's like, "Shiva, will you be homeless?" And I said, "Well, no, I have a loving family that I could move back to Islamabad." And he's like, "Okay, so you'd have somewhere to live, and would you still have your education and the experiences that you would get from trying this? And, you know, people like me and other friends that you know who would support you?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, I would still have all of that." He's like, "So then what are you afraid of?" And I remember when I actually thought about it that way, like, my worst case is a lot of people's best case, right? Right. I would still have a home. I would still have a support network. I would still have family. I would still have my education. And I would probably have more resilience. That's when I realized, okay, you know, these leaps are not that scary. And then from there, I like to leap, and I leapt and packed a suitcase and asked a friend to ship everything else and just kind of did it.
So what did those early days look like? What did you know about setting up a fund? What did you know about that whole process? I feel like the great thing about starting something is that you don't really know what you're doing and you are just forced to figure it all out in sort of a very quick boot camp. But I'm wondering what those early days were like. Did you have a process in place? Were you winging it? What was it like?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. I was asking a lot of questions, and that's something I still do. I ask an annoying amount of questions about anything. What is a 501c3? How do you set it up? What type of lawyer do you need? Do you know a lawyer? Can you give me their email? What questions should I ask them? How do I know if they're good enough to do this? I think that mindset of none of this is rocket science, and if you are curious and you ask enough questions, you'll get to a fairly good answer, and sometimes a better answer than someone who's been doing it for 25 years, because they're going to do things the exact same way they have been doing it. They're not going to ask, wait, how do we do this again? Wait, why do we do it that way? I think it's just about asking a lot of questions.
I think that's so true. And I also think it takes a certain level of bravery for people to just say, like, I don't know. And that's always rewarded by the universe, by the people around you. At least that's been my experience. And to your point, too, it's not rocket science. Like, obviously, there are some times that it is. But for the most part, there are a lot of things that can just be answered through research. It's a lot of research, don't get me wrong, but there are paths forward. And I think that's such an important point. So I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about the fund itself and the concept that you two came up with and what the idea and mission behind everything was, on the off chance that someone listening to this isn't familiar with it.
So the mission of the Malala Fund was and is to help every girl around the world get an education. And it sounds simple, but it's not. And, you know, we're part of a universe of advocates and leaders and researchers and activists and school teachers and educators and schoolgirls who are working on the same mission, which is really that in 2021, every girl should have an education, and that education should actually change outcomes, should change your ability to achieve your dreams. Because as we know, there's a lot of schools that really aren't teaching young people what they know to be successful in life. And when we're able to keep a girl in school through secondary schooling, it changes everything. And that's really where the Malala Fund focuses is, you know, when you keep a girl in school through her secondary education, she marries later, she's less likely to die in childbirth, her children are more likely to survive and be healthy and go to school, she's more likely to earn an income. And we already know the single best way to end poverty is to economically empower women. So girls' education is just such a powerful intervention, and we need more and more investment there.
Okay, so you're in New York. You're working as the CEO of the Malala Fund. She becomes the youngest ever Nobel Peace Prize laureate. This has to be the most remarkable time. And you're also just starting your career. Can you tell me a little bit about what that moment was like for the two of you, how it informed your work, what was going through your mind during that time period?
Yeah, it was exhausting and beautiful. And most of all, I just felt this deep sense of love and responsibility. You know, I was 22, 23, but Malala was 15. I loved her, still do, and her family, and they had been through hell. And I just knew the power and the purity of their message, and I wanted to just safeguard it for them, for her to get to choose how to tell her story in her own voice, in her own way, in her own time, and to use her platform in the way that she wanted to. And so I think that really weighed on me. And I carried that all the time. And, you know, the fact that today she continues to inspire so many people and has gotten this incredible education and is such a leader and has the power to use her voice, to use her platform as she chooses, is something that I'm proud of. I'm also really proud of what her story has shifted in our culture, right? This young Pakistani brown-skinned girl with a headscarf, showing the world what courage looks like. And women like her, women from my part of the world, are not seen as leaders. It's very easy to see them as victims. And that was, I believe, where people would have placed her story. But she's not a victim. She's a leader like so many other girls and women around the world who are fighting against all odds to make remarkable change in their communities. And I think that she's a real icon for that. And I believe in the power of icons of stories that shift how we view things in the world.
So you were there for a number of years. I'm curious about how your strategy changed, or maybe it didn't, during that time, because I feel like with any new company, the more you learn, once you're actually like in practice in the field, you start to evolve and understand things in a different way. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that journey a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, when we started the Malala Fund, we were just trying to make a difference. And it really started with, you know, when Malala was shot, people heard her story and wanted to help her. And so they started, I think, a GoFundMe at the time. And they were intending to send those donations to her. And her and her family said, no, we want to use this to help other girls. And so it was as small as, how do we best invest this money to make a difference? And I believe we ended up investing that towards girls' education in her hometown, in the Swat Valley. And people were really inspired by that and they wanted to do more. And, you know, I think in the nonprofit sector, and I think in many industries, there can be a lot of distance from the work on the ground. And, you know, I grew up in a country with a lot of nonprofits and a lot of nonprofits that really spent a lot of time getting big aid contracts from places like USAID. And there's a lot of distance from the work on the ground. And I think here was this girl who was literally helping girls in her community after she herself had gone through something so traumatic. And I think that really resonated with people who wanted to make sure that there was never another girl who was shot for wanting to go to school. And obviously from there, it's grown into a global organization that does, you know, highly complex and effective advocacy work and grant making and storytelling and operates around the globe. And so there's been so much growth and impact there. You know, I think sometimes you can get hung up on starting something with what is the big strategy. And I think that, you know, all of the biggest things that I've started in my life started with very small steps. And they grew from there. And yes, you've got to build things that are scalable. But I think a lot of times people get hung up in not starting something because they don't see that path to scale. And very often when you start something, that path becomes apparent with each step.
An excellent point. So to skip ahead a little bit, in 2017, you switched gears slightly and began Now Ventures to support mission-driven startups. How did you know it was the right time to step away from the fund? What was the process of starting this VC like? I have no idea how one goes about securing the necessary capital or figuring out all of the rules. I mean, I guess knowing you, you asked a bunch of questions, but how did you know it was the right time? And tell me a little bit about the process.
Yeah, it was actually earlier. It was about 2 years in. I guess to take a step back, I had become really interested in this notion of mission-driven business while I was at Stanford. And I knew I wanted to start my own mission-driven business one day. And with starting the Malala Fund, I was, you know, forced to become an entrepreneur, a nonprofit entrepreneur, but still an entrepreneur. And I was building an organization. I was learning a lot of the skills that you do as an entrepreneur. And I was also surrounded by social entrepreneurs and female founders. I was in New York building, and they were building as well. And I was seeing incredible companies and ideas. And I knew I wanted to go back into that direction. And Malala and her shooting and her courage really had pulled me into the nonprofit space, which I loved, but I was eager to build a mission-driven business. And I realized that a lot of the young people around me who were starting social enterprises were struggling to get funded. And I really felt that there was an opportunity to build a portfolio that was both financially successful and mission-driven. And in the absence of something that I was excited about building directly, I thought, can I help other entrepreneurs who do have these ideas? And, you know, we all know the statistics around venture capital and, you know, 2% of venture capital going to women, 0.2% to Black women. Yep. And of course, the added lens of, if, you know, you're building something that's quote unquote more mission-y, or, you know, there's a sense of, is this going to be a successful business, or is this sort of a nice idea that should really be a nonprofit? Of course, I was seeing my own preferences and my generation's preferences, where we were more drawn to brands that embodied our values. And so I wanted to prove that there was this real juxtaposition that you could hold, and that in fact, mission-driven brands that had something to say would be more successful. So that was really where this came from. And at the same time, you know, I wanted to re-immerse in the startup space. I knew that I had very quickly become pigeonholed as sort of the nonprofit person. And, you know, it was easy to see me in that way as a, you know, Pakistani immigrant woman. I think it was harder for the mainstream to see me as a businesswoman or an investor. And so I wanted to make sure that I was not giving up on those ambitions and what I wanted to build ultimately. Starting an angel fund really allowed me to start to support other entrepreneurs, to start to help them think through the things that I had thought through, like impact, like mission, and to start to prove that a really thoughtful mission can actually enhance business performance.
So how did you raise the capital? Let's talk about money.
So raising money for Now Ventures was very hard, and I knew that it would be very hard. I was coming in as an outsider, and I wanted to just do what I could to get enough to prove that I could do this. So I didn't pay myself anything.
Oh, do you recommend that?
I had a side hustle that allowed me to earn a living, and I had saved up a little bit. So no, not long term. But I also knew that I was doing this to prove that I could, and to understand if this was where I wanted to go career-wise.
Got it. Okay. So tell me about the types of companies that you would invest in, how you knew something really spoke to you, and how you weighed some of those decisions.
You know, when I was investing, we were writing very early stage checks. And so at that point, you don't really have revenue. Often you don't really have a product or even a prototype. And at that point, you really are investing in people, which is part of the reason why venture is so biased, because, you know, when everybody who's investing comes from a certain place, then they're investing in people who look like them and have similar experiences, right? It's pattern recognition, this notion that I've seen success over and over, and it looks like a white male, so that's what I'm going to invest in. And so expanding, I think, who has a seat at the table in early stage investing is really important, so that those early checks are written into a diverse range of founders who then have the ability to build their business and prove out that they have what it takes and that this is a great idea. So a lot of it was spending time with founders, understanding their stories, understanding their skill set, their motivations, understanding the business and the product and the market a little bit, but really believing fundamentally that this person has what it takes and will do what it takes. And, you know, a lot of early stage businesses will pivot. You know, if they pivot their business into something else, you still want to be invested because of them. So that was really where early stage investing came from for me. You know, now running a successful e-commerce business, I have very specific expertise in e-commerce and retail and brand building. And so I will invest in those industries more and take later stage investments and really sort of look at the viability of the business. But early on, when I was just investing pre-revenue, it was about the founders.
So as we know, it's a very male-dominated space, and it's so incredibly important to have more female-funded and founded VCs. So I'm curious about what advice you have to anyone who either wants to create a VC or a fund of their own. What do you wish you had known going in? What are some of those realities?
Yeah, I mean, I think that breaking into venture capital is very hard because just the way the economics work, it's very hard to pay yourself because you get a fee off the top line. And then from that, you operate the fund and pay yourself. And so you need to raise a certain amount of capital to be able to do that. So it is a hard area to break through. Hence, if you have a side hustle that allows you to start and just start proving yourself, that is often the way people will go. And of course, that is a position of privilege to be able to hold down, two things and make it work at a time. I think in addition, really sort of understanding, do you want to do this alone? Do you like to work with people? And do you want to bring in partners? How do you really thrive? Are you sort of a solopreneur, or do you want to find the right team and go out and build this with them? Also, having a specific lens and having a competitive edge. Why you? Why will you see better deals than other funds? There's a lot of capital out there. So is it because you have a specific industry expertise? Is it because, you have a certain network that is underinvested in, right? So you see a lot of amazing women starting women-focused funds because women have been underinvested in. And so there is a competitive edge there to invest in women who have previously been ignored. And then I think also just the realities of it's a no thank you business more than a yes business, right? You're going to meet hundreds of entrepreneurs and say no to them, and you're going to be wrong. And I don't like to say no, so I never loved that part. But that is, a lot of what you're doing is really judging business and entrepreneurs very quickly and very fast and saying more no than yes. And so with any job, there are downsides and upsides. And I think certain jobs are glamorized more. And I think venture is a industry that's been really glamorized because, the founders that made it raised tons of venture capital. And so I think if you want to start a fund, but also as an entrepreneur, really understanding why you're raising venture is an important question and knowing the pros and cons of it.
That makes sense. So I want to talk about your next thing, which is amazing that you have already had so many lives in this one so far. So you started working on a project that was let's call it a passion project, that has turned into a major force, otherwise known as the home cookware brand, Our Place. So tell me, in your limited time, how did you have this other idea, this other project to work on? Like, what was going on in your life that you felt the need to start something new again?
Well, I knew that I wanted to build a business. I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I had met my now husband, and we were building our lives in LA and literally finding our place in America as immigrants by cooking and sharing food and having people come over and arguing over whose cooking is better. And we realized through that there's something really incredible about the way in which home cooking brings people together. And, I certainly will say, if you come into my home today, I'm wearing my sweatpants. I speak as fluently in English as I do in my native language, Urdu. You might think I'm American, but you come into my kitchen and you won't just know who I am. You'll know who my grandmother was. And when all else sort of falls away, this connection that we have in our food to our identity, our culture, our food systems, our bodies, really everything to each other. Home cooking is where all of that lives. And some of, my most meaningful experiences come around sharing meals at a dinner table. And so we were thinking about these things as then 4 years ago, and probably more, when we were really starting to conceive of this. We were in a moment in America where there was this rising fear of immigrants and, Jews and Muslims and people of color and really anybody who was, quote unquote, other. And we just thought, what if we could start to heal some of that disconnection? And for me, connection and belonging really had always come from sharing meals with people. So that was really the first insight that led to the creation of Our Place. We ended up having a series of other revelations that all came together around cooking feels hard. And a lot of that comes from the industry, kitchenware, cookware, food media. You walk into any kitchenware store, they're selling a 16-piece cookware set. A saucier is literally a pan to make sauces. I do not know why a home cook would need a saucier.
And, you know, I had grown up in a house with two pots. There was a round one and a flat one. And the sense of really simplifying and can you make cookware and kitchenware and tools and recipes and stories that just make it easier. You know, our place is a brand that is about bringing people together. We happen to believe the best way to do that is by making it easier to cook at home so that you can spend more time cooking and sharing a meal with your chosen family. We're really about connection and coming together more so than, you know, making you into a professional chef.
So it's a great idea, but having a great idea and actually doing something with it is very different. So tell me about the process of getting to launch and what was the first thing you started to work on?
Two first things. One was really understanding our philosophy around food and culture and tradition and belonging and place and what we were going to try and say in the world and what we believed and what our values were. And that was fundamental. I mean, it's in our name, our place, right? It's about what is our place and who's welcome at our place and is it our place to speak up? And so we were having these sort of conversations and learning and educating ourselves and speaking to food justice leaders. And at the same time, we were thinking, how do we make it easier to cook at home? And everybody needs a pan. Everybody needs to, you know, even people say they don't cook. And I'm somebody who would always say I don't cook. My mother never taught me to cook because she thought it was oppressive. And, you know, then I moved halfway across the world and I couldn't feed myself and I missed her cooking. And it felt really disempowering to not be able to feed myself. And I realized a lot of my generation was feeling that way. And so why were we feeling that way? And when it started with sort of cooking tools, we then said, okay, everyone's selling 16-piece cookware sets. What do I actually want to do? I want to fry some eggs. I want to make some dal. I want to flip some pancakes. I want to steam some dumplings. Can't I make something that I can do most of that in? And so we started to really, you know, design. And our first product, the Always Pan, that was 2 years of design and prototype and testing and sourcing and redesigning and retesting and making things is really hard. Making things that have never existed before is a lot harder because we weren't doing what every other cookware brand does, which is they go to a factory, they look at a booklet, they change the color, and they call it a day. We were creating something that hadn't existed, and the shape and the form and the function and the components and everything had to be conceived and tested and prototyped. And that's what we always do. We design from scratch. And it was really hard. But as, you know, the mission, the values were coming to life at the same time, the product, this first embodiment of our product philosophy was coming to life. It was a light bulb moment of, okay, this is interesting and this is different. And we have something to say here and people will want this.
So what was the hardest thing to get right in the beginning?
Oh, it was all hard.
I mean, but there are certain things like the name or like the handle or like there's always something that ends up keeping you up at night that you didn't necessarily expect.
Yeah, I mean, different things. But I do think getting, you know, creating great product is really hard. And I think that a lot of e-commerce businesses or just businesses in general don't invest enough in true product innovation and arriving on, you know, you have this theoretical sense of make it easier to cook at home, combine use cases, but then how does that actually manifest? You know, every choice you make has its own trade-offs. You don't like the way this is looking and let's round that a little bit, but wait, then that doesn't nest anymore. And so nailing the first product and feeling really proud of the first product was a hard thing. And I'm really, really proud of our products. But, you know, the hard thing changes every day and there's always a hard thing. And I think that you can get hung up on things like the perfect name and, you know, the name Our Place. I mean, it's like everything to me. I love it. It says so much. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like we were like Our Place. And it was like, yeah, slam dunk. It was like, okay, Our Place. Sometimes you have to sit with things and keep moving forward also versus waiting for the perfect thing.
Right. That makes sense. So talk to me about launch day. What was it like? What was the offering? What was your marketing? What was your customer response?
Yeah, I mean, we were babies. We hadn't done this before. You know, we weren't seasoned marketers and brand builders. We just wanted to cook more and get more people cooking and have a conversation about, you know, where our food comes from and who taught us to cook in these ways and how all our traditions matter equally. And so we launched, we had our amazing always pan. We had some incredible stackable porcelain hand speckled plates and bowls and handmade glasses, you know, all products that we still carry and that we love and are really proud of. And we had done this beautiful photo shoot. We'd actually worked with a family of food justice leaders in South Central LA. And, you know, we were showing our product in real homes with real activists and leaders talking about real issues. And, you know, it wasn't an immediate success. You know, it was, we launched and people in the community of food justice, I think, sort of saw it and were excited. And, but it was not, you know, we launched and then we were, you know, a multi-million dollar business and it went wild. It was, we launched and we were like, okay, this is going to take work. Like, people don't know who we are yet. And we have to find ways to get the word out and to connect with people and to share what we're doing and make content that moves people. And then we just kept working away at it, you know. What's that phrase? Became an overnight success, like, you know, several years in. Like, it was a lot of hard work. It wasn't turn it on and, you know, yay, it's an IPO.
Immediate perfection.
So. Right.
But now, a little down the road, you can say that the Always Pan is a certified phenomenon. I mean, it's sold out a zillion times. It feels like every time I see an Instagram or pick up a design magazine or walk into someone's home, I see one. So how do you, or more specifically, what do you attribute that deep customer connection and success to? Because there's a very high level of penetration in my world. Like, I see it everywhere.
I would say, yes, we're very successful today as a business and we're very proud of it. We've been around less than 2 years and we're probably, I would say, the largest D2C kitchenware business and probably making one of the best-selling, you know, kitchenware items of last year and this year. And people love the product and the brand and the mission. And, you know, I'm so completely, you know, overwhelmingly grateful every day that our place is resonating. And I think that there is not one reason. People will always be like, tell me your secret. Tell me what you're doing. And I'm like, I wish that it was as simple as a thing that we did. The secret is working and trying really, really, really hard. You know, we try really hard and that's it. We try really hard to be better, to make great product that is thoughtfully and sustainably and ethically sourced, that is packaged in biodegradable and recyclable materials, to innovate, to actually make it easier to cook at home and think, okay, why are we launching this? Is this actually changing anything? Because, you know, we're not going to launch an avocado slicer. We're going to launch things that actually make it easier to cook. And that's why we have such few products and we take so long to make something. It's because we try so hard on telling stories that make people feel like they belong. You know, I'm an immigrant. I have rarely, if ever, seen my traditions represented. When my foods are represented, they are stripped of their origin. So, you know, Himalayan pink salt, that's from Pakistan. It's actually not from the Himalayas. The Himalayas are partly in Pakistan, but the salt is mined further away. But, you know, it's these consistent attempts to sort of distance.
Right.
And in food and food media is quite guilty of really erasing and co-opting the food innovations and the cooking genius and the traditions of Black and Brown communities and Indigenous communities. And, you know, when you come to our place, you feel like you belong, or at least I hope that you do. You know, we're not about making you into an amazing chef. We just want you to make something with your hands and share it with someone you love. We want to acknowledge where ingredients and techniques come from. We want to drive a conversation. And so we use our platform for good. And, you know, when less than a year into our business, we took out billboards in swing states during the election to drive voter registration with a beautiful family portrait of what we call the American family, people from all walks of life. I was in that portrait myself. And the words "America is our place." And we partnered with vote.org to drive voter registration, to get people to vote for an inclusive vision of America. And what does that have to do with selling cookware? Nothing. But we know we have a platform And we say our place, and then are we actually doing the work to make this place ours? So the secret of the success is, I think, trying really, really hard and then being really grateful when your community sees it and recognizes that you're trying. And we're not perfect. We make mistakes every single day, but we try really hard to just be better and do right and make great product and tell stories that matter and use our platform for good.
You also have been really smart with the way that you have rolled out product, in my opinion. So like, obviously, the Always Pan and new colorways and accessories like the Seamer Basket. But can we also talk about the Tradition Wear collections that celebrate underrepresented holidays? Because I think that's so smart. And I'm curious about what the impetus was for working on that.
Yes. Thank you for asking. Tradition Wear is my absolute favorite thing to talk about. It is the heart and soul of our place. So Tradition Wear really came from our own desire to see our traditions represented. And we thought, well, what if we just celebrated one tradition at a time and partnered with the community from start to finish to share stories and create products and create impact around that tradition? So I'll give you an example. Our third Tradition Wear collection was around Nowruz. Nowruz is the Persian New Year, and my partner and co-founder is actually Iranian-American, so it's a tradition we're intimately familiar with. And we ended up creating a platter that slots right onto the Always Pan for the perfect flip. So if you know Persian cuisine,
yes.
The star of Persian cuisine is a dish called tadig, which is crispy rice. It's the bottom, it literally means bottom of the pot, and it's the crispy rice at the bottom of the pot, and Persians will cook this tadig, and then at the end you have to flip it. And it's a very harrowing experience because you have a hot pot and an uneven platter, and there are videos and legends about the horrible things that have happened when flipping tadig.
It's so scary.
It's so scary.
You've also invested like 45 minutes into cooking it, and you don't want to break it at the very end. So
exactly.
Plus the heat, to your point, there's so much pressure.
Right. You've been there.
You can tell.
And so, you know, we created the world's first flipping platter. And
love it.
It allowed you to perfectly flip tadig. And we worked with Persian artists. We had amazing Persian calligraphy that said the words Nushijun, which means nourish your soul. It's the equivalent of bon appetit in Farsi. And then we worked with an entirely Persian American cast and crew. And we photographed families celebrating Nowruz and very diverse families from, you know, because within each tradition, there's so much diversity. It's, Persians are not a monolith. There are so many kinds of Persians. And, you know, we photographed the family of an incredible writer and human rights lawyer, Priscilla, and she's part Iranian and part Black. And, you know, she had her half seen, which is sort of this table of elements that Persians lay out during Nowruz. And it had half Persian elements and half African elements. And she talked about how her identities come together to make her more fully who she is. And so we created this beautiful product. We told these stories of the tradition and how it's celebrated and the nuances and the intersections. And when you go to our Instagram grid and you see the content from those days when we launched that collection, you see over and over again, thank you so much. I've never felt like I belong. I never thought an American brand would celebrate my culture. I'm so grateful that my children will get to see their culture represented in the mainstream. And being married to an Iranian who, you know, has suffered a lot of racism in his life, I know what it's like to feel that way. And I know what it means for communities who've, you know, often had to sort of put their culture aside or mute it down a little bit, and to actually just have your culture celebrated and in a way that's really authentic. And so that's what Tradition Wear is. It's a moment to celebrate traditions in an authentic way, partner with a community, tell a story, create products around that tradition, and just, you know, make space.
The Full of Pride mugs are beautiful.
Thank you.
And obviously so meaningful. And that launched on July 1st, correct?
Yes. So that was our latest, our fourth Tradition Wear collection. And it was our family brunch collection. And it was a partnership with a queer Japanese Mexican ceramicist. And her brand is Mud Witch. And she created these beautiful mugs that are hand-painted with stripes, which she describes as the new pride flag, including colors for Black and Brown communities and trans communities. And we launched that on July 1st, really after feedback from the community, where there was a sense that every corporation celebrated Pride in June and then July 1st, it was crickets. And there was a sense of, wait, where does that go, you know, on July 1st? And we were celebrating a tradition. We were celebrating brunch or chosen family brunch. And chosen family, of course, is a term that dates back to the queer community in the 1980s. And reunion after COVID, you know, people were starting to get vaccinated and they could see each other again and what it meant to come back together for brunch. And how, you know, when you're with your queer family, you know, you're able to sort of be yourself. And that isolation had been so hard for everyone, but I think specifically for queer communities. And so we were celebrating all of that. And we thought, well, why not just launch it on July 1st and say Pride's never over?
Well, I absolutely love it. Like, the product itself is beautiful. The sentiment behind it, the creator, the partnership, like all of it is so well done. So I have to ask, and you might not be able to tell me, but I'm going to ask anyway. Mm-hmm. What's next? What else do we have to look forward to?
So much. I mean, you know, we have barely scratched the surface. We set out to make home cooking simpler. Well, we set out to bring people together. And the first step to doing that was to make home cooking easier and more joyful. And, you know, we're still scratching the surface of that. We're also really excited to be in the world again. You know, our place was a brand about gathering, and then we launched 6 months before a global pandemic. And so we have become, you know, against our plan, everyone's favorite quarantine purchase, which we love. And we're very grateful that we're bringing people joy during an isolated time. But we're about coming together. And so hopefully, as people get vaccinated and the world opens again, to be able to gather and have experiences and events and classes is something that we're very excited about as well.
Excellent. Okay. So I have this whole thing about, I think the skills that we learn early in our career have such interesting and direct application, even if we go into a very different field. And I find this a very hopeful and optimistic aspect of all of our lives. So I'm hoping that you can tell me about some of the skills from either of your first lives that you find particularly useful today in your work.
So I think that one of the skills that I learned, and this is more, I think, a state of mind than a skill, is to show up. I learned to show up when I was very young. I would see something happen on the news and I would show up at the protest or organize my own. I would do what I could. I would read about, you know, a young girl wanting to get her education in the Swat Valley and find her number and call her and say, here is who I am. How can I help? And I didn't have a plan, but I wanted to be there and see if I could make a difference. And maybe because I started so young, I didn't let myself get overwhelmed by the enormity of the challenges I was hoping to address. And so that sense of, well, can I just show up and see if I can help, is something that I think is one of the traits that I most value. And I call myself a serial shower-upper, and like just continuing to show up, you know, for the issues and the causes that I believe I can impact for my team, for my business, just showing up and trying, I think is a really important trait.
So, okay, we also like to talk about mistakes on this podcast because everyone makes them and not everyone talks about it. So can you tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career and something that you learned from it?
Ah, so many. A mistake that I've made in my career has been, I'm good at this, I'm not good at this, right? The sense of, oh, no, that's not my strength. And when you're building something, if it's not your strength, it's not going to be your organization's strength. And that's something that I've realized. You have to be willing to dive into everything, and you have to stop telling yourself, so-and-so is not my strength. And so I really do try and say to the stuff that I know that I'm not naturally good at, oh, no, this, I'm good at this. I can do this. I can figure this out. Versus, here's the stuff that I'm really good at. Here's the stuff that I'm not naturally good at, whatever that means. And so I'm going to put it aside and someone's going to figure it out. I've realized you have to be willing to dive into each and every part of your organization and to get good at the stuff that you're not good at and to ask questions and hire great people. and give them the space and time to succeed. And until then, keep things moving. So I think that's one, is the sense of bifurcation.
So a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They want to do something else. They're nervous about it. As someone who has pivoted a number of times, what advice would you give someone who wants to make that leap, but just hasn't quite figured out how to do it?
I would say that leaps take many shapes and forms. And a leap can be, you know, quitting your job, moving across the world with a suitcase to start a nonprofit. Or a leap can be, hey, I want to try this other area within my organization. It might mean I grow a little bit less fast because I'm on this fast track with this field that I'm in. But well, so what? I'm really interested in this and I want to give it a shot. And I'm willing to maybe even take a little bit of a step back if I get to learn this other thing. So I think leaps can be many different things. And I don't want to glamorize, you know, big, big leaps over small ones. But I really think this notion of being guided by your hopes and not by your fears, and asking yourself, what is the worst that can happen? And making sure that your fears are real, because your fears might be, right? You might have, depending on where you are in life, you might have family members depending on your paycheck and you cannot afford to miss one. Or you might realize, you know what, if I freelance for 3 months, I'll be okay. And so really trying to understand the fundamental risk, the real risk versus the imagined risk. What will people think? What happens if I fail? You know, what if people think I'm not smart? Those imagined risks that we layer on to the real risk, stripping those away.
Last question, which is, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self and give her a little career advice at any point in your life, what would you say?
I think that a lot of women will give their younger selves advice around confidence, around you've got this, you belong, you're not an imposter here. Do not sell yourself short. Do not try and shy away from failure. Do not try and hide in the things that you know you are really naturally good at. Dive into the stuff that you might not be and figure it out and be willing to ask questions and willing to fail and always ask, you know, ask for that check. Ask for that opportunity, ask for that email address, because every time you don't ask, that's an automatic no. And you can discount that all you want, but count those no's and use that to ask for more and to show up more.
I love that. Thank you so much for doing this pod. Ah, this was such a delight. I am rooting for you in the biggest way. I think your company is so amazing. I love your story. This was so phenomenal. I can't tell you how excited I am or how much I appreciate it.
Thank you. You were so lovely.
That was the co-founder and co-CEO of Our Place, Shiza Shawhead. For more inspiring interviews with women like Shiza, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, so please tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr. The show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.